solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And the thing about this emotion that I want to reclaim it for is because in some ways we've been sold a bill of goods by saying, don't have any regrets, don't look backward, always be positive. Regrets are inherently bad. They make you weak, so you got to avoid them. And I the truth is that if we treat our regrets properly, they are a powerful force for doing better. The trouble is that they come with discomfort. So regrets clarify what we value. That's the photographic negative, and they instruct us on how to do better. That's all of these benefits. So we all want clarity, or most of us want clarity, and most of us want instruction, but none of us want the pain. But the problem is that's not on offer here. All right? What's on offer is a small amount of pain and discomfort, which is how you get to the clarification and the instruction.
Welcome to the 89th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations from leading people from various domains on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Just like businesses think about where to play and how to win in the context of their business strategy, I feel we all think about the two questions, where to go and how to grow, at various points in our lives. These questions become that much harder in a world of abundance and multiplicity of options and limited feedback as we grow through our life. Through this podcast, I hope to share some insights that might help you navigate these questions in a more thoughtful way. When I'm not podcasting, I'm typically working with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and helping them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. That's PLAYTOPOTENTIAL.com. My guest this time is the dynamic, insightful, and the super articulate Dan Pink. He's been consistently rated by Thinkers 50 among the top 10 thinkers in the world for the last few years. To be specific, he was ranked number 9 in 2021 and number 6 in 2019 for his work. He's been a prolific writer on a range of topics across motivation, selling, careers, the science of timing, and now he's just written a book on how we can work with regret to move our lives forward. Just like he mentions later in the conversation, all research is me-search. I've been curious about understanding regret in greater granularity for the last several years, and I was really looking forward to this conversation. I do think it's a powerful piece of work that has the ability to help us lead powerful lives. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Dan Pink. Dan, thank you so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to have you.
I'm really glad to be here, Deepak.
Dan, would love to dive into your book on regret in a couple of minutes, but I'm curious about people's journeys in this podcast. And I was just looking at the body of work and the books you've written. You've written the books Free Agent Nation in 2001, Whole New Mind in 2006. Then you wrote a book in the Japanese comic format, which was interesting, Adventures of Johnny Bunko. Then you wrote a book on human motivation in 2011 and on selling, To Sell is Human in 2013. And then you wrote a book on the science of timing in 2018 and now regret. Let's connect the dots for us.
Oh, I don't know if the dots are connectable. I'm not sure the dots are even meant to be connected. Mm-hmm. If there's any connection, there's certainly, I know that you were at McKinsey, and so you're a skilled strategist. It's not as if I've ever had a broad strategy for the books that I want to write up on a whiteboard somewhere, vetted by consultants. I'll give you my theory here, Deepak, which is that writing good books is really, really hard. It's a lot of work. It's really, really hard. And a lot of it, you know, even though I like it in the abstract sense, sometimes day to day, it's a struggle. You're always doing battle. And so you have to pick things that you're deeply, 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 deeply interested in, And that's not most things. And so I just move to whatever I'm deeply interested in and write about that. And if the dots connect, great. If they don't connect, who cares?
But of the various books, I was curious about the book in the Japanese art form. Tell us what's behind that. Yeah. That's not a usual choice.
Okay. So that was, I'm very proud of that book, even though I think it sold fewer copies than any other of the books. So what I decided to do there was I wrote a career guide, but in the Japanese comic form manga. And what happened is that my family and I, we did a fellowship in Japan in 2007, where I studied the manga industry, and I wrote some things about that. Manga is just comics in Japan, but in Japan, comics are used in a much wider array of forms than certainly in the United States and probably India too. It's used for business books and cooking guides and relationship guides and so forth. And I thought that a business book, a career guide in manga would be a brilliant idea. And so I hired a manga artist and we wrote I think it's a pretty good book called The Adventures of Johnny Bunko, The Last Career Guide You'll Ever Need, where this bumbling accountant named Johnny has a pair. One night he's working late and he gets some food and he snaps open these chopsticks and he has this collection of chopsticks. And each time he snaps open the chopstick, this sprightly figure named Diana emerges and she gives him a lesson in how to have a satisfying career. So
fascinating.
I'm proud of that book. I also, but here we go in the annals of bad business judgment. I right when it came out, actually before it came out, a movie producer heard of it and heard about it and said, okay, we want to option this, to turn into an animated film. And they made an offer that was like a very, very low offer. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, that's like way too little money. And besides, we're going to get plenty of other offers. And we never got another one. So.
Fair enough. Let's move to the current book. Dan, you call this a regret reclamation project. Talk to us a little bit about the origins of this book. How do you end up getting curious about regret?
Well, I think it was for a whole host of reasons. You know, there's an old line in certainly in social science, but I think in other forms of science, which is that all research is me-search. And so for me, I think that was partly the case. I was at a point in my life where it's a weird point in my life where I had mileage behind me, which kind of surprised me. Mm-hmm. I mean, really surprised me, but then also in mileage ahead of me, I hope. And I was dealing with some of my own regrets and just thinking about them, not just pondering them and trying to make sense of them, not debilitated by them at all. And I found something interesting that when I very, very sheepishly mentioned them to people, very sheepishly, because nobody wants to talk about this, I found that people leaned in. They wanted to talk about it. They wanted to share their regret. And I got a kind of this kind of electric response that, again, going back to your initial question, for a writer is like a really good piece of data. It's like, whoa, wait a second. I've had other topics where I bring it up. I have an idea and I bring it up and people just start fleeing the room or their eyes start glazing over. And this one was just the exact opposite. People were like, whoa, hey. And I thought that was really interesting. And I really wanted to make sense of it myself. The other thing, I guess, as a writer, maybe there is a little bit of dot connecting here, is that a lot of the books that I had written were a little bit more they weren't as much about emotions, and I never really taken on writing about emotions, and that's obviously really important. And this emotion of regret ends up being a very important emotion. But to make just to put a pin on it, to put a button on the end of it, is like, I can't imagine having written this book in my 30s. There's no way. But in my 50s, it felt almost inevitable.
Got it. Actually, one of the things I wanted to, it struck me in this podcast, we also talk about people's journeys and careers. You're trained as a lawyer. And,
yes.
And you've just written a book on regret. One second, I was just curious. If you really, before we dive into the book, Dan, if it's okay with you, I'd love to know,
sure.
Are there one or two big pivotal choices you made that have got you to where you are now after a degree in law?
I think that the two pivotal choices were going to work, becoming self-employed. I think that was a really important moment. That was about 25 years ago now, amazingly, where I'd been working in some political jobs here in the United States. I became, through no fault of my own and without any planning, a political speechwriter. And I realized that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life at all. I didn't want to do it the rest of my 30s. And what I really wanted to do was go work for myself. And I think that was pivotal. And then a few years before that, I think that marrying my wife was pivotal. Those are the two of the most pivotal decisions that I made.
And if I may persist for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, persist.
In what ways did your marriage shape your career in the context of where you are now? I'm curious.
For a whole host of reasons, because, you know, when you work for, so ultimately what happened is that Jessica was working as a lawyer and then we had a kid and then I went up to work for myself and she kept her job and she kept her health insurance because we needed to, support ourselves. And that went on for a while. And then when I began to establish, ever so slowly began to establish my footing, she left her job and we ended up essentially working together for the last 20 years or so. And so that was really essential. The other thing is that, you know, when you work the way that I do, there's a very porous border between work and family. And so if on the other side of that porous border is not support and love and empathy and intelligence, it becomes very, very hard.
Got it. Let's dive into the book, Dan. You call this the photographic negative of the good life one could lead. I just found that phrase just kept percolating through my head ever since I've read your book. Talk to us about what you have in mind when you say this.
Well, I'm glad because, you know, the thing is, Deepak, you understand what a photographic negative is. People who are under 25 do not. I'm not even kidding around about that. People whose only notion of photography is digital photography truly have no idea what I'm talking about.
That's a good point. It didn't occur to me.
That's why. I mean, I have to say, like in the book, I kind of felt like an idiot because I wrote a couple of paragraphs about what a photographic negative is. And the only reason I did that was for readers, you know, basically 25 and under who would have been mystified by what I'm talking about. Anyway, so what I meant by that is that my view is that if you understand what people regret the most, you understand what they value the most. And what I did is that I went out and collected a lot of regrets from around the world. We have now, at this point, you and I are talking in early March, we're now over 19,000 regrets from 109 countries. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
And what I found is that around the world, people ended up regretting the same four things. Mm-hmm. And that those four, but when people tell you what they regret, they tell you what matters to them. And so if we understand these regrets, we understand what people say makes life worth living. And that was the kind of thing where I was trying to, it's one of the good things, going back to your initial question again, like one of the things I like about being a writer is being surprised. Mm-hmm. And that came as a little bit of a surprise to me because I was trying to make sense of this emotion of regret, going through all of the academic research on regret to say, okay, how does this emotion operate? What does it mean? What does it do for us? How prevalent is it? I also did a piece of quantitative research here in the States, a very large public opinion survey to try to get American attitudes about regret. And then essentially for storytelling purposes, for emotional texture, I wanted to collect a bunch of regrets from around the world. I got way more than I ever anticipated. And those ended up revealing something that surprised me, which is exactly what you say, which is the photographic negative.
Hmm. And you talk about the four core regrets, Dan. Now might be a good time just to sort of double-click on that. Can you give the listeners a sense of what these core types of regrets are?
Sure. So my argument, and I think I'm more right than wrong, is that the way to understand what people regret is not to look at the domains of their life. And by domains, I mean, this is a career regret. This is an education regret. This is a finance regret. This is a health regret. But to go one layer beneath, and I think one layer beneath, there are four core regrets. One are what I call foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. And these are people who regret not working hard enough in school or university, people who regret a lot of regrets about not saving money, about spending too much and saving too little, a lot of regrets about poor health choices. So it's small choices early that accumulate to negative consequences later. Second one, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. And these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret, a lot of people regret not pursuing a romantic interest, not asking somebody out on a date. A lot of people regret not speaking up, not asserting themselves. People regret not starting a business. So that's boldness regrets. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. Again, these are people who, you know, all these regrets begin at a juncture. So you can, you know, so people are at a juncture. They can do the right thing. They can do the wrong thing. They do the wrong thing and they regret it. And so we have a lot of things about a lot of regrets about bullying, more than I ever would have expected. A lot of regrets about marital infidelity. And then, you know, different notions of morality that aren't necessarily consistent from place to place. This is the one, moral regrets are the one area where there is some variation nationally. There is some variation based on political view, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, connection regrets are, if only I'd reached out. It's all about relationships that have come apart, usually slowly and undramatically. People want to reach out. They don't. They think it's going to be awkward. They think the other side's not going to care. So it drifts even further. And all of a sudden, the relationship, sometimes it's too late. So, and when you look at these things, I'll just triple click here. The, when you look at these things, each of these four core regrets, to me, reveals a need. Foundational regrets reveal our need for stability. A good life has some stolidity to it, some predictability to it. Second, a good life is a good life has growth and learning and psychological richness. That's boldness. A good life has goodness in the sense that I think all I'm really convinced that most of us, the vast majority of us, want to be good. We want to have a life where we're being good. And then the other one is love. And so so this negative emotion of regret, this emotion that we often say we don't want to think about, we don't want to reckon with, actually ends up revealing the path to a life well lived.
Lovely. And in your research, Dan, is that a pattern around the incidence of these four kinds of regrets? Do you see much more of one versus the other? Can you give us a sense of how it plays out?
I think so. But here's the thing. So the regrets that I collected, it's all qualitative research. So I'm loath to make like definitive claims because it wasn't a random sample and all that. But what you saw pretty overwhelming, I have a lot of regrets. What I saw overwhelmingly is the two biggest categories were, the biggest category is connection regrets. The second biggest category are boldness regrets. And then moral regrets was a pretty small category. So, but it seems like connection and boldness comprise well over half of them.
Got it. And I'm also curious, since you've written a book on career pathways, two decades back, one of the things I noticed, Dan, is there's a multiplicity of pathways today compared to maybe 20 or 30 years back.
Yeah.
And I was sort of reading this book by Barry Schwartz on paradox of choice. And he says, in a world with abundance, two things happen, right? One is there's FOMO. You feel you should have done something else. And second is there's decision fatigue. Specifically on this point of FOMO, I'm just trying to see in the context of regret, is there a difference to the way regret shows up today than, let's say, maybe it might have 20, 30 years back when the world was a lot more predictable?
I think so. And it's a very, very insightful point because Barry Schwartz was one of the first social psychologists to write about regret. And it informed some of his work on the paradox of choice. And so there's some interesting I have some interesting quantitative data on that point. So I got like four different pathways here for you. So
fascinating. I didn't know he'd written on regret. I knew he'd written about choice. Okay.
No, he did. Barry was one of the first people to write about regret, and he didn't do a lot on it, but he did some really good work on it. And he also, he's been circling this topic in a number of different ways, which I'll tell you about here in a moment. So let me take on FOMO here for a moment. Mm-hmm. So FOMO is about anticipated regret, right? All right. So you're looking for, so here's what we got. Regret itself is a backward looking emotion. So what happens? You look backward in time and you say, if only I had made that choice, not made that choice, taken that action, not made that action. Okay. FOMO is actually more of a forward looking thing. We're mm-hmm. worried what's going to happen in the future. I don't want to miss out on something that's going to happen in the future. And so we can also anticipate our future. We can anticipate our future regrets. We can anticipate our future regrets. Now, doing that, anticipating our future regrets can be very healthy behavior if we do it right. The problem is that we often don't do it right. And here's where Barry's work is very instructive on this. Barry and others have written about two different ways of making decisions. This is in a lot of his stuff. There are people who are maximizers. They say, I am the people that McKinsey consultants have in their heads as consumers, right? They want to make the best choice for everything. And so they say, what shirt should I wear today? I'm going to wear the best shirt I can wear today. What kind of pizza am I going to order tonight? I'm going to have the best pizza I can possibly get tonight. What color should I paint my house? I'm going to find the best kind of paint and the best painter to paint my house, right? And what Barry and others have found is that maximizers are miserable. They're just miserable because you can't maximize everything. There's always going to be something better. It's a perfect way to drive yourself nuts. And that people who do something else, which is called satisficing, that is make a good enough decision, generally are pretty happy. And so when we think about FOMO, what we want to do is that we want to actually focus on the thing. So FOMO isn't all bad, but we have to think about what are we really going to miss out on? And so when we anticipate our regrets, we can use these four core regrets and say that I'll just take me as an example. The me of 2032, the me of 10 years from now, is not going to care about certain like should I post a picture of what I'm eating for dinner on Instagram tonight? Or I don't want to miss out on letting people know what I'm eating. The me of 10 years from now is not going to care about that. The me of 10 years from now is not going to care about painting my house. But we do know what the me of 10 years from now is going to care about, where he will be upset if I miss out, where I should have some FOMO. All right. And that is, did I take the appropriate risk and lead a psychologically rich life? Did I do the right thing? Did I reach out to people I care about? That I should have FOMO about those things, the core things that we know make life worth living, and forget about everything else. And I say that less as a prescription and more as a, more as a prediction, because we know from this body of regrets what the me, we can make a safe bet what the me of 10 years from now is going to care about. So I'm forgiving that long-winded answer, but what you want to do, and again, Barry's work is instructive here, is you want to maximize on what's important and just satisfice on everything else. So have FOMO about not connecting with people you care about. Have FOMO on not taking an appropriate risk. Have FOMO on not building a stable foundation. But forget about most other things.
Fascinating. That's a lovely way to frame it. And I should pick up on one of the terms you've used a couple of times already, Dan, psychologically rich life. What does the term mean to you?
Yeah, that's not my term. That's a term that's emerging in the field of psychological science. And what it means is that, like, psychological richness is a concept that has to do with we want to do things that are interesting, that are meaningful, so awe would be part of psychological richness. Learning would be part of psychological richness. Personal growth would be part of psychological richness. Beauty would be psychological richness. Hearing a wonderful symphony, seeing a, you know, so it's things that that enrich our lives in a, but not in a, not necessarily in a material way, but the kinds of things that just give us joy and meaning, and that's a catch-all term. It's an emerging term right now in the world of psychological science, and I like it because I think it captures some of what is going on with those boldness regrets.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. The point that Dan makes around maximizing and satisficing also came up in a different conversation with Dr. Ashley Willens of Harvard Business School. She speaks about the notion of time poverty and how we can avoid it, and links it back to the notion of satisficing versus optimizing.
And I think in general, we all fall into this maximizing trap. In at least some of the dimensions, it falls out for everyone a little bit differently. Maybe you're someone who really wants to have the best pair of shoes, so you'll spend hours and hours and hours trying to find the perfect business shoe or the perfect sneaker. That's probably equally as good as some other shoe or sneaker. And maybe we should be spending less time searching for the absolute best in that consumption decision, and instead satisfice and find a pretty good shoe that's pretty stylish. And there's good research suggesting that individuals in general who spend more of their time maximizing consumption decisions on an everyday basis are less happy than people who spend more of their time satisficing on the small decisions that we're all faced with on an everyday basis. And of course, as related to time, we've actually now shown this direct link. Satisficers, like the French that we studied, are better able to savor and are happier as a result.
I often notice that a lot of us transition from a context of scarcity in growing up to a context of abundance when we start working. However, our operating system is still wired for the scarcity context, and there's a temptation to maximize and optimize in everything despite the changed context. And that can cause significant discontent and happiness. If you're finding the podcast of value, do take a moment to rate and review on Apple, Spotify, or any other platform where you consume this content. It will make a big difference to guests building trust with us, our platform, what we're trying to do here, and listeners discovering this needle from a haystack of content out there. Now, let's get back to Dan Pink.
And moving on to one of the things you say in the book, you say that leaning into regret could help us make better decisions because it slows us down and helps us gather more data.
Exactly.
Can you say more yeah. about how this plays out?
There's some very good research on this, and I think that it's the kind of thing that your listeners would benefit from, because there's a direct, I mean, it's actually decent coaching advice too, because, again, built on the research. So, for instance, there's research on negotiations. Mm-hmm. So that you, so let's say that you engage in negotiation, and then and the negotiation is over, and then you stop and you think about what you regret in that negotiation. Now, that's a weird move here too, because remember, regret is a negative emotion; it hurts. So you're inviting discomfort. You're inviting some negativity. You're inviting a small dose of pain, when in fact, we're mostly encouraged, never look back, always be positive, all right? So, but what the research shows, Adam Glinsky has done some of this, at Columbia has done some of this research, you invite some of that pain and negative emotion, and the next time, you do better in the negotiation, right? Mm. The same thing is true with all kinds of problem solving. You're in a problem solving exercise. Instead of saying, okay, I didn't do that well, never look back, you actually say, okay, what do I regret? Once again, you invite the negative emotion. You don't try to bat it away, you invite it. And what does it teach me? You do better next time. There's some interesting work on senior business executives with regard to strategy, to strategic thinking. And so over and over again, and this is the key, you know, you mentioned at the top, Deepak, that describing this, which is how I describe it, and I think I'm glad you picked up on it, as a reclamation project for regret. Mm. I want to reclaim this emotion. And the thing about this emotion that I want to reclaim it for is because in some ways we've been sold a bill of goods by saying, don't have any regrets, don't look backward, always be positive. Regrets are inherently bad. They make you weak, so you got to avoid them. And I the truth is that if we treat our regrets properly, they are a powerful force for doing better. The trouble is that they come with discomfort. So regrets clarify what we value. That's the photographic negative. And they instruct us on how to do better. That's all of these benefits. So we all want clarity, or most of us want clarity, and most of us want instruction, but none of us want the pain. But the problem is that's not on offer here. All right. What's on offer is a small amount of pain and discomfort, which is how you get to the clarification and the instruction.
Hmm. And in the book, I loved an image where you have three people on a podium and you have the picture of bronze medalist being happier than a silver medalist. And you sort of use that to make a point about how we frame regret. Can you sort of expand on this? I showed it to my 12-year-old daughter and she got it. You know, it just made it so intuitive.
Oh, good. That, did she? But she understood the reason why?
She did. I think intuitively.
Yeah, very good.
She may not have found the language for it, but I think she got the context quickly.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating. So this is some really interesting research started. Actually, the initial research on this came out in 1992. So it's 30 years ago at the Barcelona Olympics. Tom Gilovich at Cornell and Vicky Medvec, now at Northwestern, then at Cornell, did some really interesting research. And what they did is that they showed, as you say, the photographs of Olympians at the medal stand. And what it showed is exactly what you said. Gold medalists are ecstatic. Bronze medalists are really happy. And silver medalists aren't that happy, even though they got the silver medal at the Olympics. And so the reason has to do with, again, our incredible brains. Our brains are, the more I write about behavior and brains, the more I'm just in awe of what our brains can do. I mean, it's extraordinary what our brains can do. It's extraordinary. And one of the things our brains can do is something known as counterfactual thinking. That is, we can imagine scenarios that run counter to the facts. And there are two kinds of counterfactual thinking. One of them is a downward counterfactual, where you imagine how things could have gone worse. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like downward counterfactual. It's too complicated. I like to call it an at least. And so the bronze medalists are like, oh, at least I got a bronze medalist rather than the schmo who finished fourth, who doesn't have any medal at all. So they imagine. So here's the thing, at least make us feel better. And that's okay. That's actually a psychological, that can be a healthy way of doing things, a healthy way of interpreting events. The silver medalist is saying, if only I had kicked a little harder in the final turn, I'd have won the 100-meter freestyle race. And that's an upward counterfactual. If onlys make us feel worse, but they make us do better. And so this is another way of understanding. And so regret is the quintessential upward counterfactual. It can help us do better. It makes us feel worse and helps us do better. It helps us do better because it makes us feel worse.
So from a performance perspective, Dan, just building on what you just said, how do you work with these two, right? At some level, in a way you're saying we need to have some sort of a switch that flips. You know, when we are practicing, some sort of upward counterfactual is helpful. But once the results are out, it helps to take the other view. So do you have a view on
how we play with this? It depends. Okay. So here's the thing. Let's see if we can figure out a career example here, which might be more relevant. So let's say that, so here we go. So let's say that somebody, we'll call him Vishal, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job. It's a childhood friend of one of my kids, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job and it is and he hates it. It's terrible. It's a terrible job. He really doesn't like it. Okay. And he realizes that he made some mistakes in even taking the job. It wasn't that there were warning signs ahead of time. Okay. So So he's feeling regret about that. Now, what can Vishal do about that? So let's say that, so what Vishal can do about that is say, you know, if only I had done more due diligence ahead of time and researched this company a little bit more, if only I had talked to three people who were in this position beforehand, I would not have made this choice. Okay. And he can take those lessons and carry them forward and looking for his next job, knowing now that he has to do some due diligence, that he has to find surrogates for that kind of job, that he has to maybe talk to his mentor. Maybe he didn't talk to his mentor to get some advice on that. Okay. So he's like, okay, I really messed up here. Now that feels bad. He can make himself feel, he can still get that instruction and mitigate some of the pain, not all of it, by saying, but at least I got paid decently, so I'm not in the hole. And so you can do both. Now, if he were to simply to say, at least I'm getting paid decently, he's not going to change. He's going to be stuck in that bad situation. So it's possible to do, it's possible to do, and if only without an at least, but sometimes if you're willing to take the pain of the if only, as Vishal just did, you can mitigate some of the pain with an at least.
Got it. And is the at least the sort of the conceptual point there similar to the notion of gratitude, having gratitude for what we have?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting way to put it. I'm not sure. I never thought about it that way, but I think that's a really nice way to put it. My hunch is that they're probably adjacent or connected in the roots or somewhere. That's a great point. I never thought about that, but it probably is. At least are a way to essentially recontextualize your situation in order to make yourself feel better. But the problem is with at least, and that's okay sometimes. The problem is that at least don't help you do better. At least confer zero performance benefit. They mitigate some pain, and mitigating pain is cool, but they don't offer any instruction.
Got it. In the book, you say that regret doesn't always have a positive effect. If you let it linger too long, or if you replay the regret too often, it can have the opposite effect. How do you think about the Goldilocks balance of, you know, using regrets to improve our condition?
It's a really, really important point, and it's super important here. So we have to look for sort of a third way in. So some of us are taught, okay, you've got emotion. I think part of it is that most of us haven't been taught how to deal well with negative emotions. And so at some level, some of us, you know, people who, you know, I think there's a slight, there might be a slight bias for people who have high levels of formal education, who say, well, no emotion, emotions. No, that's not a real signal. Like you ignore emotions. Emotions aren't real. Ignore them. That's a bad idea. Then there are other folks who think that emotions are the main source of truth. And so they wallow in their negative emotions. So emotions are not for ignoring. They're not for wallowing. Emotions are for thinking. Emotions are signals. Emotions are data. Emotions are information that's coming in, and you actually have to confront them. If you don't, and what happens sometimes is people spend so much time ignoring the emotions that eventually the dam breaks and they can't ignore them anymore. And then they end up wallowing them. So, and I think a big part of it is that no one ever teaches us how to deal with negative emotions. And so we don't have a good, you know, underlying theory about what feelings are for. You know, in my view, feelings are, especially negative feelings, negative feelings are for thinking. We got to think about our negative feelings as signals, as messages, as data, as knocks on the door, at whatever metaphor you want to. And so we shouldn't be terrified by it or brought down by it, but we shouldn't neglect it either. It's an email that we have to answer. But the problem is that most of us haven't been taught how to do that effectively. And I think that's a big problem. I was looking for massive, again, I don't, the qualitative stuff from around the world, you know, by its very nature, I can't draw stark conclusions from, but I'm really curious about whether there are cultures or traditions that do a better job of dealing with helping people, equipping people with negative deal with negative emotions. Hmm.
The related question that came up as I was reading the book, Dan, was in your research, while you've captured a lot of the what people are saying when it comes to regrets, what have we learned about how people, are there any practices that you've discovered which helps people listen to their regrets? Is it journaling? Oh. Is it meditation? Is it something else?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a systematic way to deal with these regrets, to deal with our retrospective regrets that we haven't been taught. So I look at it as inward, outward, forward, inward, outward, forward. So inward is like, how do you reframe how you look at the regret in yourself. That's the first step. And that what you see is that when we make mistakes, particularly, you know, accomplished people like who listen to your podcast, when we make mistakes, the way we talk to ourselves is absurdly cruel and vicious. I mean, you would never talk that way to anybody else. And so what you want to do is initially is treat yourself with what's called self-compassion, which is the work of Kristen Neff at the University of Texas in the US. And it basically means treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Recognize that your regrets are part of the human condition and that any single mistake is just a moment in your life, not the full definition of your life. But what happens is that if you were to, I mean, it's incredible. If you were to sort of put an electro, you know, put some kind of amplifying device in people's heads and broadcast the way they talk to themselves to the external world, I think people would be horrified. You'd be horrified to hear myself talk. I mean, like, you know, I think if I talk to other people the way I talk to myself in an organization, I'd be fired, you know? So my point is, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Second thing, this is really important is the outward, is that there is something, important in disclosure. When we disclose things, it's an unburdening. When we disclose things, it's actually a way to build affinity. That a lot of us fear that when we disclose our vulnerabilities, people will think less of us. The preponderance of evidence shows people actually think more of us when we do that. Hmm. But the most important thing is this, that emotions by their very nature are abstract. They're amorphous. That's what makes positive emotions feel so good and negative emotions feel so bad. So with negative emotions, what you want to do is you want to convert them, that when you write about them or talk about them, you convert this blobby abstraction into words which are concrete and less fearsome. And that begins the sense-making process. And finally, so we're outward, inward, outward, forward. You need to draw a lesson from it. And this is about our problem-solving skills. And while human beings are pretty good problem solvers, we're pretty terrible at solving our own problems. So what you want to do is something called self-distancing, where you zoom out and look at the problem in a way that is if it were somebody else's. So you talk to yourself in the third person. You imagine having a conversation with the you of 10 years from now. You do things like ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do? There's a great business example of this from Andy Grove, the former CEO of Intel, who always, as a decision-making tool, would say, all right, I'm trying to decide what to do. What would my successor do? So when we ask ourselves at a personal level, I'm trying to make a decision, what would I tell my best friend to do? We almost always know. Andy Grove said, what would my successor do? He almost always knew. And that's because in order to solve problems for ourselves, we need to be zooming out rather than be so enmeshed in the details.
Actually, in McKinsey, we would, one of the founding fathers of McKinsey was Marvin Bower. And one of the questions that we would be told is, what would Marvin do in the situation
as a
frame of decision making?
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Yeah. That's fascinating. But that's another way to do that. And there's so much good evidence of that. And so when we do these things, you can interrupt, you know, again, some people wallow and ruminate in their regrets, but you can interrupt that march toward rumination. If people know what to do, they say, treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt, disclose, convert to language to make sense of it, do some self-distancing to extract a lesson from it for next time. And if you do that, it becomes habitual. And then you get improvement. You get that initial jolt of pain from the regret because regret hurts, it's negative, but you have a systematic way to turn that pain into something productive.
Hmm. And one of the things you spoke about just now, you use the term illism. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. I-L-L-E-I-S-M, where you talk about yourself in the third person.
Yes.
Can you just expand on that? There's one particular community in India, in Kerala, in South India, which does that in the language as a default. That's sort of the nature of the language when
really. So they don't have a first. There is a first. So first person is an exception, and so third person is the default.
For example, if we were sitting in the room, I wouldn't say, "Would you want some coffee?" I'd say, "Would Dan want some coffee?" When I talk to you.
Oh, okay. So it's not. Well, how would you refer to yourself in that language?
It's a good question. I've seen that in the context of the second person. Probably not in the case of the first person. So yeah, I stand corrected.
Okay, but that's still it's still very interesting because it shows you. So, but it shows you like how we like our language. Well, this is a controversial point, but that change in language can produce a change in perspective. That's the thing about the third person. But the thing is, if you ask me that question. If you and I are in, I've been to Kerala, I've been to Cochin. Mm-hmm. Kerala is famous for its vindaloo. I know that.
Yes, and so, among many things, yeah.
Yeah, among other things. So religiously diverse state in India as well. Very yes. beautiful too. But I think that when you, like, if I were to respond to that saying, yes, Dan would like some tea, that's very interesting. I mean that's super interesting, and again it goes to so much of this goes to how we construe problems, and we want to construe problems both. We want to have the ability. It's almost bilingualism. We want to have the ability to construe problems on both the abstract level and the concrete level, both in the micro and the macro. And sometimes linguistic shifts can move us there, but we need to actually, since we don't do that automatically, we need to come up with ways to do that. That's why what would Marvin do is such a brilliant technique. What would my successor do? What would I tell my best friend to do? It's so powerful.
Got it. Dan, in the book, you refer to the Japanese art form kintsugi, and you speak about how regrets can help us discover our uniqueness and find our own pathway.
Yeah.
And you go on to say that the cracks are how the light gets in. A lot of the leaders I work with are at a point of transition and they're trying to figure out what next, you know, in their journeys, given the career they've had, given their passions and given the market and so on. And this particular phrase stood out for me. So can you expand on this notion of kintsugi and sort of using the cracks to let the light in?
Yeah. So we are spanning the cultural references here across the Pacific Ocean because the cracks are how the light gets in is a lyric from a song by Leonard Cohen, the Canadian singer. Mm-hmm. And kintsugi is an ancient form of Japanese pottery where what happened is that in the old days that pottery would break, they sent it out to be repaired. The repair was terrible. Then they sent it instead to some artisans to repair it. And the repaired pottery was more beautiful because it did this really elegant job of stitching up the seams and whatnot. And so kintsugi is this gorgeous form of pottery that is not that is broken, but it's not beautiful despite its crack. It's beautiful because of the cracks and the way they've been joined together. And so as a writer, I can't resist the metaphor. And I think that is a metaphor in some ways for what regret does for us, that if we acknowledge the cracks, if the cracks are how the light gets in, if we recognize that we've all the product of mistakes and regrets and setbacks and things like that, and instead of papering over them, instead of smoothing over them, we actually kind of acknowledge them. There's a beauty in that, and there's also, I think, there's a performance advantage in that because you're spending time moving forward rather than trying to portray this perfect image of yourself. So, so I love that as a, I love that as a metaphor. And, you know, it ends up being, you know, so if you have career sort of seasoned professionals in transition, thinking of themselves as like, okay, where are the cracks? I think that can be a very healthy way to approach things. The other thing about, I think that comes out, sort of, if I can make a regret related point here in terms of these career transitions, is that one of the things you see with boldness and connection regrets in particular, one of the things you see more broadly is that people have many more regrets about inaction than action. Mm. They regret what they didn't do more than what they did do. And so I think there's an argument in general in life to have at least a slight bias for action. And I think the reason, and I think the reason for that is that in some ways we've gotten it wrong. And here I'm going to steer this ship around to the point about career transitions, mm-hmm. is that if you look at career transitions, I think a lot of times what we want to do is, or transitions of any kind, we want to think it through, plan it out, come up with a strategy, and then execute on the strategy. And it doesn't mm-hmm. always work that way. In fact, Erminia Barra at the London Business School has some great work on this, which is basically like acting is a form of discovering. That's one of the things that I've learned in my life. It's that you can't just figure out everything. Sometimes you just have to act. And so, and I think that the regrets that people express, since they're so overwhelmingly about inactions rather than actions, to me, it says in the grand scheme of life, you want to have a slight bias for actions, because it's not only how you get stuff done, but it's also how you figure stuff out.
Fascinating. She's been on the podcast as well, and she uses a phrase.
Oh, great, yeah.
Acting, you know, act your way into a new way of thinking is a phrase she
right.
uses.
Which exactly. Which, that's a better way. It's her work. So, she started working on this like maybe 20 years ago in her book, Working Identity. And it's been real. I think it's totally smart. I think it's totally on point. And again, like in some ways we have the sequence wrong. We think that, yeah, exactly as she says, you have to act yourself into a new way of, act yourself into a new way of thinking. So again, it's another reason why I think in general, we should have a bias for action, because acting is how we figure stuff out. And also we're more likely to regret inactions.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here once again. I learned something similar from my conversation with Bruce Feiler, author of the book Life is in the Transitions. He speaks about a classic scene from Indiana Jones where he needs to take a leap of faith into the unknown first, and then the bridge appears. If you have a couple of minutes, I would strongly, strongly urge you to go to YouTube and check out this small clip. I think that this is a profound metaphor to the way transitions often play out, especially when people become more experienced. Bruce Feiler expands on that notion here.
There is something about the fact that the great stories of every faith involves going into the wilderness in some aspect. It's in the Hebrew Bible. It's in the Hindi tradition where you go into the forest. It's in the Buddhist tradition. It's in the Muslim tradition. Okay? It's in the story of all of the great mythologies have somebody going on a journey of some kind. And that journey in a fundamental way is leaving what's secure and safe and going into this period of lack of confidence and wilderness and transformation and fear. So if the first phase is the long goodbye, where you accept it and you use rituals in some way, the next step involves taking a step and going through that process. And that brings you to the Indiana Jones scene, where let's remember, here he's in one place and there's a cliff and there appears to be no bridge. He actually has to take a step, and then the bridge appears after he takes the step. That's what it's like to go into this messy middle. And it involves two processes fundamentally. The first is to shed some habit, some way of life. Maybe it's shedding you like having a job and it's shedding that comfort of stability. Maybe it's shedding a habit maybe you've been a people pleaser and you've stayed around something for too long and it's taken you too long to say goodbye. And you realize you have to stop trying to please your boss. Maybe you have to stop trying to live up to the expectation of your parents, that dare I say it. Okay. Maybe your parents have fed you these expectations that you must have a certain status and you must bring in a certain kind of money and you must do something that you don't want to do. And you realize, I'd rather do something that I want to do. Or maybe you have to say, I want to stop making money and I want to start giving back to society. You want to shapeshift. So you have to shed some expectation. This is the first half of what the messy middle involves. And then the second half is absolutely astonishing acts of creativity. Once you shed things from your life, you suddenly have room to try new things. OK, Okay, maybe it's a new habit. Maybe it's a new skill. Maybe you start to paint. Maybe you start to dance. Maybe you start to sing. Like, people literally do actual things. Like, think when the pandemic happened, everyone was posting pictures about learning to bake, right? That was the, I may have been the only person who was not surprised by this, because even the act of baking something small is an act of reimagining. If you can imagine that you can bake something and that you can eat that, and that little act of imagining that creation allows you to imagine that you can make and bake and create your new life. And that's what happened. It begins with small steps, just like Indiana Jones, sometimes on a bridge that you don't even know is there.
If you're at a point of transition, I would strongly, strongly recommend the conversation with Herminia Ibarra and Bruce Feiler to give you some perspectives around how to frame your thoughts for the transition. You might also find the curated playlists, Navigational Principles, and Reinventing Yourself of value. You can just check them out at playtopotential.com and in the tab Curated Playlists. Now, let's get back to Dan Pink.
And you speak about omission and commission. I love the phrase you use in the book, Dan. You say, inactions by laying eggs under our skin incubate endless speculation. I love.
Yeah, well, that's a line from an American poet named Ogden Nash, who wrote about why, you know, sins of omission linger more than sins of commission, because they lay eggs under our skin. And I think that comes out very clearly in all the research. It came out very clearly in my quantitative survey. It came out very clearly in the interviews, especially as we age. And there's an age effect here. When we're young, we tend to have relatively equal numbers of action regrets, what we did, and inaction regrets, what we didn't do. As we age, the inaction regrets take over. And I think a reason for that is that with certain kinds of action regrets, you can undo some of them. So let's say you've hurt somebody, you can make amends. I just got a note from a reader who had literally this weekend, the weekend we're talking, who said that he had some regrets about how he had treated people in his life, three people in particular in his life. And he read the book and he went back and he apologized to them. He made amends to them. And that way, and so in a way, like, he's kind of hasn't fully extinguished the regret, but he's mitigated it considerably. So action regrets, you can make amends, you can make repairs, you can do something about. You can do some at leasting of it to make it feel a little bit better. But with inaction regrets, they, as Ogden Nash says, they lay eggs under your skin. They're not going to go away.
And in moving to connection regrets, Dan, you speak about open and closed door regrets, and you also speak about rifts and drifts. I love the pithy words to sort of digest these things.
Yeah.
Can you say more about the distinction between these kinds of regrets and what how we can get the most out of them? And more specifically, you urge us to lean into awkwardness and err on the side of showing up.
Well, that was a big takeaway from these, especially from the connection regret. So let me start with the second part. So we're going to talk about open doors and closed doors. We're going to talk about rifts and drifts, and we're going to talk about awkwardness. So let me start with the second one first. So connection regrets are about these relationships that have come apart. And one of the things it surprised me that when you read people's regrets, and then I interviewed a couple hundred of these people, 190 or something of these people, what you find is that the way these relationships come apart is not especially dramatic. It is much more likely to be a drift than a rift. It's much more likely to come apart slowly, imperceptibly, spreading apart like this, rather than, you know, some kind of cataclysm. And I think that's very telling. And so what happens then to the second part of the third part of your question, as these relationships come apart, they drift apart. What happens is that one side wants to reach out and they say, it's going to be really awkward to reach out, and the other side's not going to care. And here is where we're wrong. On so many different levels. I heard it anecdotally. You see it in the research. We woefully overpredict our feelings of awkwardness. When we reach out, it's not nearly as awkward as we think, number one. But number two, and perhaps even more important, the other side almost always cares. And so we're wrong on both fronts. We say, oh, it's going to be awkward and they're not going to care. But you know what? It's not very awkward and they always care. So, so this is interesting. It's sort of like the bias for action. So to me, it's like when in doubt, reach out. You know, if you're at a juncture where you're thinking about reaching out, should I reach out? You've answered the question by being at the juncture. Now, the trouble here is that, let's go to the first part of your question, open doors and closed doors. So I'll give you, there's a story in the book of a woman who had a friend, a childhood friend she grew up with, actually in New Jersey, where you used to live. Mm-hmm. And she had this childhood friend who she grew up with, and they were very good friends as kids, and you know they stayed in touch as young women, not super close, but stayed in touch. She found out that her friend had a very serious form of cancer, and this woman wanted to reach out. I'm going to reach out. Oh, but it's going to be awkward. She's going to think it's weird that I'm calling her because she, you know, da da da. And finally, when she decides to call. She calls and she finds out her friend had died that morning. And so that's a closed door. You can't do anything about that. The open door, and the only thing you can do with a closed door regret is learn from it. And this woman, Amy, she actually did learn from it. But with the open door regrets, you still have a chance to do something. And I think for a lot of our relationships, the door is still open. But as you say, we have to push past our awkwardness and reach out.
And on a related note, Dan, you say you refer to disclosure, compassion, and distance in the way we deal with regret. Are these related points in terms of how we make sense of regret and use that to move forward?
Well, yeah, that's what I was talking about before. I've sort of refined my thinking a little bit about inward, outward, and forward. But yeah, so inward is self-compassion, sort of, you know, treat ourselves with kindness. Self-disclosure is just revealing it or even just converting it to language. And then self-distancing is zooming out and making sense of it. And I really do think that there is a systematic way to deal with this. The problem is that most of us never learn how to do it. And you see this, you know, one of my concerns is among younger people who seem to be getting just debilitated by negative emotions because they feel a negative emotion. They feel a regret. They made a mistake. And they think that there's something wrong with them because they look around and they feel like everybody else's life is so perfect that they're somehow broken. And that's debilitating. And that can actually lead them into dangerous rumination.
And that observation, is that linked or is that amplified by the social media where people end up posting a sort of positive sided elements of their life and people have a distorted perception of how others are doing? Are these connected?
I don't know, but I think so. And I think that if you look at social media, you would think that that individuals never have anything bad happen to them except that they have a political opponent who's a terrible person. Like that's the only negativity, you know. So political discussions are entirely negative, but when you look at people's presentation of self, it's almost uniformly positive. I have this idea. I hope one of the many academics who's been on this show will hear this and do something. I want to know. Okay, so here's my research project for you to figure out. All right, here's what I want to know. I want you. Let's take something like Instagram. I want someone to do, you can probably do this with some kind of AI. What do you do? Here's what you do. You take, you know, a billion Instagram posts, photographic posts. And what you do is you reconfigure the images. So you take out the people. Mm-hmm. All right. And all you're doing is an evaluation of the weather in the background. And I'm convinced that you will have you in then you say, oh, what proportion of the days are sunny, rainy, cloudy? All right. And then my guess is that if you look at, you can narrow it by geography. All right. You can do every post in Mumbai. All right. For 3 years. And then you compare that to the actual weather in Mumbai for the last 3 years. And it's going to be like, oh, it never rains in Mumbai. It's never cloudy. It's always sunny every single day.
Fascinating. You're right.
I think my true answer, honestly, because I haven't done the research and some of the research on the effects of social media is very, very mixed. Mm. My own instinctive response is that it doesn't help. Mm. It doesn't help in terms of in people doing the endless social comparison and the endless FOMO that is distracting and then sort of doesn't allow them to focus on what I think the evidence tells us really matters in life.
Got it. Going back to one of the things you mentioned, Dan, about how regrets, especially in the context of drifts, you know, sometimes it's like a frog in a boiling water kind of a thing. I think you make a broader point about some of the regrets, the core regrets. You say that they creep up on us over time. In these kinds of situations, I'm curious about, as journeymen and journeywomen, as we go through our life, how do we ensure we catch ourselves and not succumb to the frog in a boiling water situation when it comes to some of these regrets?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure I have a systematic way to do that. I mean, I do think that there's something to be said for regular self-assessments. Peter Drucker has a technique that I use, because Peter Drucker figured out everything that you and I thought we figured out 50 years ago. I can't think of what it's called, Deepak, but I do it myself. That what you do is you write a memo, or you say, here is my prediction of how the next 6 months are going to go. And this is what I do. And I can't think of what Drucker, it's not my idea, it's Drucker's idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to think through the next 6 months and here's my prediction of how things are going to go. And then I put it in Dropbox and I never look at it, except that I put 6 months from that date, I put a tickler in my calendar to look at that. And then I see, okay, so where were my forecasts right? Where were they not? And at some level, that kind of punctuation mark, that kind of assessment might allow us to do that. I feel like there's the way to avoid the frog in the boiling water is to sort of set a timer and stick your finger in to see how hot the water is getting.
Hmm, lovely. I love the phrase punctuation mark. Just an ability to pause and reflect and take stock and move.
I've become a bigger believer in various kinds of punctuation marks, because otherwise our lives are just it's like free verse, and it's hard to. You know, it's like what Robert Frost said, free. So I'm going to get all the hate mail from poets. But Robert Frost said that free verse was like playing tennis without a net.
Fascinating.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman, here once again. I love the point about punctuation marks that Dan makes here. These sometimes provide us with discrete opportunities in a continuum to take action. In this context, I heard something valuable from Katie Milkman, a professor at Wharton and the author of the book How to Change. She speaks about the notion of a fresh start and the fact that if we look carefully enough, there are enough and more fresh start opportunities that provide the punctuation mark that we need.
What we found is that there are moments, this won't surprise you at all, that feel more like fresh starts to people. And the one that we're all familiar with already is New Year's, right? This is a moment when around the world, people are setting resolutions at a higher rate than usual, trying to pursue goals at a higher rate than usual. And it feels like a fresh start. The psychology of New Year's turns out to be familiar and extend to many other moments. But the psychology of New Year's is you can say sort of, well, that was the old me last year. The old me couldn't achieve this, you know, right? The old me tried to quit smoking and failed, but that was a whole different person. The new me and the new year can do it. And you feel this dissociation from your past failures and this renewed optimism as you open a new chapter in life. What we found is that New Year's is actually just one moment that has that new chapter, fresh start feeling. There are lots of other moments on the calendar and in life when we also feel we're turning a page and can get that same dissociation from past failures and motivation, and also the likelihood that we might actually step back and think big picture about our lives is greater. So some of those moments include, according to our research, the start of a new week or a new month, the celebration of holidays that feel like fresh starts in our culture, the celebration of birthdays, and of course, there's other research looking not only at these sort of psychological or temporal markers that give us the sense of a clean slate and a fresh start, but if you physically change environments, that has not only psychological appeal and helps you, but it can literally disrupt routines in a way that's helpful as well.
Finding punctuation marks, like Dan says, or fresh start opportunities, like Katie says, could be interesting approaches to deal with the awkwardness of drifts and the regret that comes with it. Let's get back to Dan Pink to wrap up our conversation. Couple of questions before we wrap up, Dan. You say that we need to adopt a journey mindset as we go through life. And I was processing that in the context of regrets. Give us a sense of what you have in mind when you say.
Well, this is from some work by Jennifer Ocker at Stanford University, who says who found something pretty interesting, is that when people pursue goals and they reach the goal, reaching the goal is often somewhat unsatisfying and in a weird way demotivating afterwards. And you're like, well, what? Wait a second, that doesn't comport with what I know about goals. And what she said is that what you really want to do is actually think of things from a journey mindset. That is, the whole point is to continue the journey, to keep going on the journey. There's and I think that's a useful way. I mean, you use that word, Deepak, multiple times in this interview. You know, what's the journey that you're on? Because I'm not sure if we ever know the specific destination. I mean, I think there's some way stations along the way where we want to actually aim toward that destination. But once we hit that destination, that the destination is only sort of a stop along another kind of journey. There's another metaphor that I like from James Karst, who wrote a book, 50 years ago, maybe, where that he calls finite and infinite games. So a finite game, the goal is to win. An infinite game the goal is to keep playing. And I think goals and destinations are useful in certain circumstances. I don't want to bypass them entirely, but I think more broadly, we want to actually look at our lives as a journey, as an infinite game where the goal is to keep playing.
Lovely. Dan, as we wrap up, five quick questions, top of mind answers, one line, two lines, whatever. Just brief.
Okay, I'll try to be more concise than I usually am.
No.
All right.
If you need to expand, feel free.
Okay.
So first.
Oh, yeah. That's don't say that to me.
What surprised you the most in your findings about regrets?
How universal they were. In the quantitative survey, I did a very large sample of the U.S. population, in part so I could look at demographic subgroups for differences, and there weren't that many. If you look at the World Regret Survey, the national differences were scant.
While Jeff Bezos is known to use regret for decision making, are there other well-known leaders that stand out for using regret as a decision making tool?
I think Andy Grove's. Andy Grove's idea, which we talked about what will my successor do, is a really good one. And I think that Bezos's idea that you want to minimize your future regrets is right if we focus on the core regrets and not on every regret.
Got it. Which of the four types of regrets have you personally found most challenging to deal with?
Oh, interesting question. I think the moral regrets, in part because I have some regrets about kindness that I would put in that category. And it's a peculiar kind of moral regret in that a lot of moral regrets are about actions rather than inactions. And my moral regret is actually about inaction, having to do with kindness, where I was in many situations when I was a younger person where people, I never bullied anybody, but where people were being mistreated or being excluded, and I knew it and I didn't do anything. And that really bugs me. It's something that I've tried to work on, but I still feel that
little spear of pain each time I think about it, which is good.
It goes back to your earlier point about omission regrets laying eggs under the skin, I guess, in a way. It's one of those.
That's a good point. Right. And what's interesting about that is that many moral regrets are, I bullied somebody, I cheated on my spouse, I hurt somebody, you know, whereas for me, whatever, I'm not the only one, but for me, my moral regret was a moral regret of inaction. I stood by while people were being mistreated. I knew it was wrong and I didn't do anything.
Fascinating. What's the most common misconception you see people having about regret?
Oh, that it should be avoided, and that it's inherently destructive, and that's wrong on both counts. That it should be reckoned with properly, and when we do that, it's actually extremely constructive.
And last, if we want to understand the power of regret, is there a movie or a book that comes to mind that sort of illustrates this?
You know, the one that comes to mind is an American movie called It's a Wonderful Life, which is a good movie about counterfactual thinking. And it's a good movie about at leasting. And it's a movie about this guy who decides that he's going to kill himself. And he's visited by an angel. And the angel shows him what life would be like had he never been born. And it's a terrible, dark and situation. He realizes that his life has value.
Fascinating.
But there have been regret hinges on storytelling. So there are a lot of, you know, there are movies and things that show, you know, what would have happened if you had made this choice or that choice or that choice. I think that's one of the reasons why it's such a compelling topic, because it hinges so much on storytelling.
True. Groundhog Day was another movie that came.
Oh, Groundhog Day is a great one. Yeah.
As I was reading your book.
Yeah.
Just as we wrap up, Dan, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Given all the work you've done along the way, including regret, for the purpose of listeners, what does the phrase "play to potential" mean to you?
It's an interesting question. I think that what it means is, I don't want to get overly deep on you. you could have a companion podcast called Deep with Deepak, but I don't want to get overly deep on you. But I think what it says to me is that, you know, we're not here forever. We're on this planet for a vanishingly short amount of time. And you need to use your gifts. You need to not sleepwalk through life. You need to offer as much to the world as you possibly can by playing to your potential. And so to me, it's a reminder of, you know, if we're reminded of immortality, we're reminded that we need to be our very best selves and contribute as much as we can during the very, very short stint we have here on this planet.
On that note, Dan, pleasure having you at the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the nature of my advisory work, you can just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you, and look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.